I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Iraq's Prime Minister Iyad Alawi is in Washington today, joining President Bush in the Rose Garden for a joint news conference. Earlier today, Alawi addressed a joint session of Congress. We're going to hear much of that in a moment, but first, let's go right to the Rose Garden where the president is speaking.
...and demoralize Iraq's allies. Because of that, Prime Minister Alawi and I believe terrorist violence may well escalate as the January elections draw near. The terrorists know that events in Iraq are reaching a decisive moment. If elections go forward, democracy in Iraq will put down permanent roots, and terrorists will suffer a dramatic defeat. And because Iraq and America and our coalition are standing firm, the Iraqi people and not the terrorists will determine Iraq's future. There's much at stake. Mr. Prime Minister, you recently said, "The war in Iraq now is not only an Iraqi war, it is a war for the civilized world to fight terrorists and terrorism. And there is no route but the route of winning." Prime Minister Tony Blair recently called the struggle in Iraq the crucible in which the future of global terrorism will be determined. I share the view of these strong leaders that Iraq is a central front in the war on terror. And our only option is victory. We're making steady progress in implementing our five-step plan toward the goal we all want, completing the mission so that Iraq is stable and self-governing, and American troops can come home with the honor they have earned. First step was achieved on June 28th, not only on time, but ahead of schedule, when the coalition transferred full sovereignty to a government of Iraqi citizens. The second step is to help Iraq's new government establish stability and security. Iraq must be able to defend itself, and Iraqi security forces are taking increasing responsibility for their country's security. Nearly 100,000 fully trained and equipped Iraqi soldiers, police officers, and other security personnel are working today, and that total will rise to 125,000 by the end of this year. The Iraqi government is on track to build a force of over 200,000 security personnel by the end of next year. With the help of the American military, the training of the Iraqi army is almost halfway complete. And in Najaf and other important areas, Iraqi military forces have performed with skill and success. In Najaf, Iraqi and coalition forces effectively surrounded, isolated, and engaged enemy militias. Prime Minister Alawi and his government reached out to the local population to persuade citizens the path to a better future would be found in political participation and economic progress. The interim government then negotiated from a position of strength to end the standoff. Serious problems remain in several cities. Prime Minister Alawi believes this combination of decisive action and outreach to peaceful citizens is the most effective way to defeat terrorists and insurgents and secure the peace of Iraq. And America stands with him. The third step in our plan is to continue improving Iraq's infrastructure. On television sets around the world, we see acts of violence, yet in most of Iraq, children are about to go back to school, parents are going back to work, and new businesses are being opened. Over 100 companies are now listed on the Iraqi Stock Exchange, and an average of 5 new companies are joining each week. Electricity has been restored above pre-war levels. Telephone service has increased dramatically. More than 2,000 schools have been renovated, and millions of new textbooks have been distributed. There's much more work to be done. We've already spent more than $1 billion on urgent reconstruction projects in areas threatened by the insurgency. In the next several months, over $9 billion will be spent on contracts that will help Iraqis rebuild schools, refurbish hospitals and health clinics, repair bridges, upgrade the electricity grid, and modernize the communications system. Prime Minister Alawi and I both agree that the pace of reconstruction should be accelerated. We're working toward that goal. The fourth step in our plan is to enlist additional international support for Iraq's transition to democracy. The multinational force of some 30 nations continues to help secure a free Iraq. We honor the servicemen and women of Great Britain, Bulgaria, Denmark, El Salvador, Estonia, Hungary, Italy, Latvia, the Netherlands, Poland, Slovakia, Spain, Thailand, and Ukraine who died, besides Iraqis and Americans, for the cause of freedom and security of the world. Our coalition is grateful that the United Nations has reestablished its mission in Baghdad. We're grateful to the G8 countries and the European Union for pledging support to the new Iraqi government. We're grateful to the NATO alliance for helping to train Iraqi forces. We're grateful to many of Iraq's creditors, which have agreed to a further reduction of Iraq's debt. Because all nations have an interest in the success of a free Iraq, I urge all nations to join in this vital cause. The fifth and most important step in our plan is to help Iraq conduct free national elections no later than next January. An Iraqi Electoral Commission is now up and running and has already hired personnel and is making key decisions about election procedures. Just this week, the Commission began a public education campaign to inform Iraqis about the process and encourage them to become voters. United Nations electoral advisors are on the ground in Iraq, though more are needed. Prime Minister Alawi and I have urged the UN to send sufficient personnel to help ensure the success of Iraqi elections. At every stage in this process of establishing self-government, the Iraqi people and their leaders have met the schedules they set and have overcome their challenges with confidence. And under this good man's leadership, they will continue to do so. The war for Iraq's freedom is a fight against some of the most ruthless and brutal men on earth. In such a struggle, there will be good days and there will be difficult days. But every day, our resolve must remain firm. Prime Minister, today I want to leave you and the nation you serve with a clear message. You have not faltered in a time of challenge, and neither will America. Thank you for your leadership. We're honored with your visit.
Thank you. Mr. President, thank you for those kind words. It is an honor to be here today in your nation's capital. It is a great honor to share this platform with you, a leader who worked tirelessly for the liberation of my country. These last few days have been difficult for us Iraqis, for you Americans, and for all our allies. Let me start by saying that my thoughts and prayers are with the families of those fighting today in Iraq, and in particularly with the families of those who have lost loved ones at the hands of the terrorists or the insurgents. Like this nation, which in the face of such brutality is standing strong against terrorism, so we Iraqis will not be cowed by the terrorists. Your government and my government understand what is at stake today in Iraq. Today we face a concentrated campaign by terrorists and by the enemies of all the values which we hold dear, a campaign to shake our resolve and to prevent Iraq and Iraqis from attaining the freedom and democracy which we have dreamed of for more than the last 30 years. These terrorists understand all too well that success in Iraq will be an enormous blow for terrorism worldwide and an enormous step forward for peace and stability in the Middle East and in the wider world. I thank you, Mr. President, for your determination to stand firm with us in Iraq and for the unflinching message which you are delivering to our enemies. Mr. President, I stand here today as a Prime Minister of a country emerging finally from dark ages of tyranny, aggression, and corruption. Like you, I knew how evil Saddam Hussein and his regime truly were. Like you, I knew the damage he had brought on his country. Like you, I knew of the wars he had started and the dangers he posed to my region and the world. Or at least I thought I knew. For I, like millions of other Iraqis, were forced into exile, realizing that we could only fight Saddam from outside Iraq. Even then, we were not safe, as I myself can testify. But when I returned to Iraq, following the liberation of my country, I was truly shocked by just how much damage Saddam had done to in his 30 years of rule. Iraq is deeply scarred society in a very troubled region. Today we are witnessing all too vividly the true extent of the damage which Saddam inflicted on our society. Mr. President, Iraqis, thank God, thank America, and thank our allies that Saddam is gone. We are safer, the region is safer, the world is safer without him. But the scars will take time to determination to heal. Again, Mr. President, I thank you for your leadership. We had an excellent meeting today, building on the talks we had on Tuesday in New York. We discussed the challenges ahead of us and how to confront them. We discussed the plan to take Iraq through these difficulties and to ensure that democratic elections take place on time next year. And we discussed the importance of maintaining the strength of the coalition and the support of the international community in helping us to succeed. As we discussed, the plan focuses on building democracy, defeating the insurgency, and improving the quality of life for the ordinary Iraqis. Our political plan is to isolate the terrorists from the communities in which they operate. We are working hard to involve as many people as we can in the political process to cut the ground from under the terrorist feet. Of course, we know that terrorism cannot be defeated with political tools alone, but we can weaken it. Ending local support helps us to tackle the enemy head on, to identify, isolate, and eradicate this cancer. Our military plan will enable us to build and maintain security across Iraq. Ordinary Iraqis are anxious to take over entirely this role and to shoulder all the security burdens of our country as quickly as possible. We do not want the multinational force to stay in Iraq any more than you want to remain there. But for now, we need you. We need the help of our American and multinational partners while we continue to accelerate the training of Iraqi security forces. The Iraqi government now commands almost 100,000 trained and combat-ready Iraqis, including police, National Guard, and Army. The government have accelerated the development of Iraqi special forces and established a counter-terrorist strike force to address the specific problems posed by the insurgency. Our intelligence is getting better every day. You have seen that in the successful resolution of the Najaf crisis and in the targeted attacks against insurgents in Fallujah.
Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi speaking in the Rose Garden today. Before him, we heard from President Bush. When we come back, we'll have some analysis and also hear from John Kerry, his comments vehemently disagreeing with the assessment of the situation. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We were listening earlier to President Iyad Alawi of Iraq and President Bush holding a press conference in the Rose Garden in Washington. Earlier today, Mr. Alawi thanked America for its sacrifices and commitment to Iraq. Well, Faye Bowers covers national security for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us now on the line with some assessment of this morning's speech before Congress. Hi, Faye.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me.
Well, and thank you for being here. And the president and the prime minister continue to paint not exactly a rosy picture of what's happening in Iraq. President Bush and Prime Minister Alawi seem to be setting the stage for even more violence, but again, calling on America to stand firm against the violence that's occurring now and the violence that's anticipated to escalate.
That's right. I think particularly with the bad news streaming out of Iraq, Prime Minister Alawi did a very good job at marrying up Iraq's nascent political process with the global war on terror, which will play well to President Bush's constituency here in America. And I think, you know, the major challenge for the both of them was, with this bad news streaming out of Iraq, to show the other reality on the ground there, that there is progress in some of these other areas being made.
President Bush saying most of Iraqi school children are going back to school, 2,000 schools renovated, textbooks delivered, modernization of communications. The timing, as you said, is got to be important on the heels of John Kerry's strongest speech so far against the war in Iraq and President Bush's lukewarm reception at the UN to his speech this week.
That's right. As you well know, the global war on terror and the war in Iraq play much differently in the rest of the world than they do here in the United States. And I think, as well as from John Kerry, you're hearing very negative assessments coming out of all sorts of think tanks, like the Center for Strategic Analysis and Study here in Washington, the Pentagon numbers and officials themselves. You know, basically assessing the situation as pretty negative.
Yeah. Well, John Kerry held his first Q&A, if you will, with reporters at a fire station in Columbus, Ohio. He hasn't done this in a long time. He vehemently disagreed with the assessment of the war given by President Bush and Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi. Instead, Kerry said that terrorism is a consequence of the war in Iraq and that the country has become a magnet for terrorism and that reconstruction is failing. Let's listen to John Kerry.
The United States and the Iraqis have retreated from whole areas of Iraq. There are no-go zones in Iraq today. You can't hold an election in a no-go zone. So it's time to talk the truth and the reality about the numbers of troops on the ground.
That's John Kerry speaking today. Faye Bowers is on the line with us. She's national security reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. And we're also joined now by Democratic Congressman Ron Kind of Wisconsin. He's just returned from Iraq. And Congressman, Prime Minister Alawi said elections would happen in January. They might not be perfect, but that they would happen. And the values of liberty and democracy are taking hold. You've just returned from the region. Do you think it's possible that elections will take place?
Well, Robin, good afternoon.
Hi.
I certainly hope so. I mean, that should be the goal, to try to stabilize the country. It's all about security right now. I think these elections are important. Yet right now, given the sanctuaries where a lot of the insurgents are operating out of, something has to be done. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there won't be that safe and secure environment for average Iraqis to feel confident enough to go out and participate in these elections come January. But not to hold the elections puts us in a box, too, because al-Sistani, the Shiite cleric leader, has come out and very forcefully and clearly stated that without elections, we're going to be losing a lot of the Shia support in the country as a consequence.
And Faye Bowers, as we were saying, a candidate Kerry today criticized the assessment of both President Bush and Alawi. A difficult tightrope to walk because, as you saw this morning, both sides of the aisle in Congress gave him warm applause because how could you do anything else?
That's right. Well, as Senator Kerry mentioned, the no-go zones in Iraq, we didn't hear Prime Minister Alawi address Fallujah this morning. We heard him address Samarra, a city that's had some success in thwarting terrorism. But we also heard Alawi put out a figure that I hadn't heard before. He says that as much as 30% of the insurgents are foreign fighters, and that's a figure we haven't heard here in the United States, that the Pentagon routinely says 5,000 foreign fighters. Mm-hmm. So does that mean the insurgency is growing, that more people are coming across the borders to fight, or does it mean it's about the same? I think we're not really clear on that picture.
Congressman Kind, big speeches today, a big press conference. What do you need the president or the prime minister to say that you feel you haven't heard?
Well, first of all, Robin, as far as where the insurgents are coming from, that's contrary to the intelligence briefings that we just received in Iraq. They were telling us that there are some elements of foreign infiltration going on, but they're not the bulk of the insurgents that we're seeing, former Baathists that are organizing this, for instance. So I don't know where Prime Minister Alawi is getting his figures, but it's different from what we were informed.
I'm going to hold you up right there, Congressman Kind, because Faye Bowers covers these issues. Faye, your sense of where the truth lies as to who these insurgents are?
I think, you know, from what I'm hearing from intelligence sources is that numbers of Arab fighters are joining the conflict from neighboring countries, from Syria, from Saudi Arabia, from Iran.
And
I don't think they know the numbers.
Well, I was just going to say this is the problem with Iraq right now. Congressman Kind, just a few seconds, if you could tell us quickly what you'd like to hear.
Well, you know, this was my second trip. I was there a little over a year ago, and it was entirely different this time around. Unquestionably, the insurgency has grown. They've become more sophisticated. They're getting better in their coordination, the type of weapons being used. Security is the name of the game. And I'm frustrated because we've been there for a year and a half right now, and it appears as if we're backsliding on reconstruction, on the training of Iraqi security forces, in securing these communities for average Iraqis. And this is coming, you know, just shortly before the national elections in January. And I don't think the president is really leveling with the American people right now and the challenge that we're facing in that country today.
Well, as the president and the prime minister tell the country to stay the course. I want to thank you both for joining us as we listened into the press conference in Washington, D.C. Faye Bowers is national security reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. And we also spoke with Congressman Ron Kind of Wisconsin. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks.
And stay with us. There is more ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Tropical Storm Ivan is once again threatening the Gulf course, the coast. The storm, which came ashore last week as a level 4 hurricane and caused widespread damage in Louisiana, Alabama, and Florida, has reformed in the Gulf and now appears headed again for the U.S. coast, somewhere between the mouth of the Mississippi and Louisiana, west to Sargent, Texas. Meanwhile, Floridians have been told to prepare for what may be the fourth hurricane to hit Florida this season, as Hurricane Jean takes a turn in the Caribbean and heads towards the state's east coast. As a tropical storm, Jean left a path of destruction on the island nation of Haiti last week. At least 1,000 people have been killed there by floodwaters, and some 1,200 are reported missing. Hundreds of international aid workers are now in Haiti trying to dispense food, water, and medical attention. The city of Boston has a long connection to Haiti. The Haitian community in Boston is the third largest in the U.S., and that community is pooling its resources to send aid to the area, especially to the worst affected city of Gonaïves. Here now, reporter Audie Cornish has more on the story.
Hello?
Pierre Imbert is director of Dorchester's Haitian Multi-Service Center, which has long served as the heart of Boston's Haitian community, the third largest in the U.S. His phone continues to ring, with calls from everyone from the city's Haitian consulate to local public health and relief groups to neighborhood people trying to catch the day's news.
Sometimes you pick up a phone and the person is speechless. You hear the gasp and so forth. I mean, then you prompt them to, you know, to speak it out, to share in the feelings. That's very important in terms of coping with the reality that we are facing a formidable challenge. And people in Haiti depend on us because they cannot do it alone. And Boston has always been a big sister to Haiti.
One of the largest cities in Haiti, Gonaïves, has been slammed by the storm. So far, some 800 people have been confirmed dead, with thousands believed to be missing.
Some storms that wouldn't have such a great effect on other countries. In Haiti, it really destroys so many buildings, so many lives, largely because of deforestation.
News services are reporting that the bodies of men, women, and children are piling up at the city's morgues. International workers are fending off mobs of people with outstretched hands who need food and clean drinking water. Imbert keeps up by scanning the internet for updates.
Meaning the tropical storm Jean the number of victims seems to be heavier by the hour. More than 700 people have already perished, are confirmed dead.
But other than information, Imbert says there is little he can offer anxious families who have come in and out of the center over the last few days.
People come for comfort. People come to share in news, to learn what's going on. People come to bring what they have. And then people come to just to be a part of this grieving process that other brothers and sisters are going through.
Down the hall, one of the center's caseworkers, Liota St-Pierre, is trying to work, even though she's distraught over her brother and his family, all of whom who live in Gonaïve.
And I'm thinking about not only my family, I'm thinking about the people in Haiti, not only in my country, but when you realize the water came to the house, they have only one clothes in the body, you know. Everything is gone, no food, nothing to cook, you know. Where did they sleep, you know? I don't know.
St-Pierre lives in Boston with her niece, but she doesn't know how to talk about it with her brother's daughter. As phone calls zigzag across the U.S. and Haiti, St-Pierre heard from relatives in Port-au-Prince that her brother was trapped on a rooftop, like many other Haitians, reportedly clinging to trees and other high spots to avoid the rushing mud and water. But now she's heard that that may not be true.
I'm thinking about if I was in Port-au-Prince and I can get my car to go to Gonaïve and try to get some people and see how I can help them, you know, get them some clothes, cook for them. It is very sad.
Pierre Imbert says people like St-Pierre are reliant on erratic messages and drips and drabs of news from local low-frequency radio stations, which he tries unsuccessfully to tune into in his office. The relief effort in Boston is in its early stages. A group of Haitian community members has been meeting at the Haitian American Public Health Initiative in Mattapan Square. Roger Jean-Charles, a teacher and doctor at Boston Medical Center, and Jean-Marc Jean-Baptiste, director of the Health Initiative Program, head the meeting. Both are from Gonaïve and have managed to get word from the island that their parents are okay.
So I believe that Haiti has gone from a political chaos to natural chaos, I would say.
Jean-Baptiste says the government of Haiti was already shaken by a violent uprising which led to the departure of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide out of the country in February. It's in no shape to provide aid to the nation. Moreover, Gonaïve was an agricultural center for the island, providing economic sustenance in its rice crops. Though mainly the northern coast of the island was hit, Roger Jean-Charles says it's a cultural loss as well.
But it turns out that Gonaïve is the city of independence. Gonaïve is to Haiti what you would say Philadelphia is to the United States in terms of being the city of independence. It has a major historical role in the history of Haiti.
The men say that many people on the island are distrustful of banks and have made a practice of keeping their savings in their home, money that is sure to have washed away, along with their homes and livestock. Roger Jean-Charles is going to Haiti on Monday, where he'd been planning to move to start a medical program for physicians and will now help the relief effort. But he says Haitians in the U.S. can make donations or help in getting the word out.
The other thing that we need also, because the communication is so difficult, if people can call their relatives and just word of the mouth, just to find out what's going on, who disappeared, who is unaccounted for, whatever loss they have known. And the more information, really the better.
So far, Jean-Charles and other prominent Haitians have come up with a storm victims relief fund, though they are still unsure whether to accept food, clothing, or other items because there is no way to get it to the devastated area.
That report from Here and Now's Audie Cornish in Boston. And as always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And you can mail us a letter. Mail your letters to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. And please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from. Still to come, from personal memoirs to the Lost Boys of Sudan, we speak with author Dave Eggers. You're listening to Here and Now. A new ad by the Bush-Cheney campaign is drawing attention. It shows John Kerry windsurfing, crisscrossing a screen, and it says his policies do much the same. In other words, they go whichever way the winds blow. Well, the ad adds to the other images this political season. On Tuesday, we spoke with the director of a film which lauded the accomplishments of John Kerry in Vietnam. Today, another filmmaker with a very different point of view. Former journalist and Vietnam vet Carlton Sherwood is president of the Red, White, and Blue production company. His new documentary is called Stolen Honor, Wounds That Never Heal. Sherwood told Here Now's Bob Oakes that he represents a group of veterans opposed to Kerry's candidacy because they say Kerry betrayed American POWs when he testified before Congress in 1971.
For all of three decades, we have had an opinion of John Kerry, and I say we, mostly combat Vietnam veterans. We remember him distinctly from 1971 and his infamous Senate testimony, where he vilified virtually all Vietnam veterans and repudiated his own military service before the Congress. I decided to do a documentary myself, focusing in on the immediate consequences of John Kerry's testimony.
You interviewed 17 POWs, and what do they say about what effect John Kerry's testimony had on their lives at that moment while they were being held?
To some, they were confronted directly with John Kerry's testimony.
Confronted by their captors.
By their captors, by interrogators. You have to remember, and of course most people don't remember, that these men were never given by the North Vietnamese communists POW status. They were always considered to be, by their captors, to be war criminals. And this was just further proof of that. Actually, it was the best proof that they had.
But you know that other POWs in camps have said they never heard about John Kerry's testimony while they were being held, nor even heard his name mentioned in camp.
Well, some of the POWs that I spoke with didn't hear John Kerry's name by name, but he was referred to as the American naval officer. You got to remember, these guys were scattered in various locations.
Well, I'm curious, though, as a journalist, if it adds authenticity, why not include both sides in the film?
Well, I did. Actually, these interviews are hardly edited. Again, you got to remember, these guys are in isolation, and isolation even from each other. And in some cases, they were actually in rooms together. So the circumstances were different for different fellows.
Now, I know that you're a Vietnam vet, and I say that as a prelude to the next question. Why does John Kerry's anti-war record matter today, in your opinion?
Well, it matters today, especially for combat veterans, because that was the real target of his rather acrimonious testimony.
But, you know, I have to interrupt you because, not all Vietnam veterans feel the same way about John Kerry. There are many, many who side with him, who stand with him, who are active in his campaign.
That's for them to decide. And I don't question that. That is for them. I have not forgiven. And I have not forgotten.
Is your group of 527, are you using this money to, are you turning around and donating this money to the Bush campaign, or are you planning something else?
No, let me answer the first question. We're not a 527. We're an independent production company. I hate to draw the analogy, but just like Michael Moore. The entire cost of this documentary, producing it, the travel expenses, everything associated with it was paid for by contributions from Pennsylvania veterans. We are not and have not been affiliated in any way, directly or indirectly, with any campaign either, well, anyone's campaign. This is deeply personal, not political. This is about what John Kerry did and he did to us a long time ago. And why it's relevant to today.
Carlton Sherwood, thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Carlton Sherwood is president of Red, White, and Blue Productions, which has made the movie Stolen Honor, Wounds That Never Heal.
Here and Now's Bob Oakes. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In 2000, at the age of 29, Dave Eggers wowed the literary world with his best-selling memoirs, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, recounting how he raised his 8-year-old brother after the death of their parents. Since then, Dave's launched a new literary magazine and befriended a fellow named Valentino. 20 years ago, at the age of 5, Valentino fled the civil war in Sudan and somehow made his way to Atlanta. Dave Eggers returned with him to Africa for a book that he's working on about the lost boys of Sudan, and he joins us now to talk about that and other projects. Welcome.
Thanks.
And not to put too fine a point on it, how much did you identify, with someone called a lost boy?
Yeah, that's a good question. He and I have talked about that because we feel like we share a few strands of DNA. The odd thing is that Valentino left his home when he was very young, assuming that the Mujahideen, which is very much like the Janjaweed that's right now terrorizing Darfur, it's the same guys, outfitted by the government in Khartoum. He left home thinking and assuming that his parents were dead. And it wasn't until much later, when he was at a refugee camp in Kakuma, Kenya, that he realized that they were still alive. So we went back to Sudan in December and sort of snuck into the country and found his family in his village in Mariel Bay. And so it was the first time he had seen them in 17 years. And they were all there. He met a number of his siblings that he had never met before, but it was a pretty amazing experience. And but the story of all the lost boys is a really fascinating and complicated one, and more is becoming known about.
This, for fans of Dave Eggers, you, is very different writing. You play this very straight. This isn't about you and, finding humor in the tragic or...
I don't appear. There isn't the word I until the last section. It's his story, and it's just so biblically grand and unbelievable almost that it doesn't need any embellishment at all. But, I studied journalism in college, and that was officially what I was supposed to be doing. So I just feel I'm going back to what I was taught, do a service to a story that needs to be told.
There's one very little flag to fans of your memoir. You mentioned your brother's videotaping some of the trip. How is your brother?
Toph,
Toph.
He's doing great. He's in college out here. And
do you guys realize how much people care about this 8-year-old boy and, his journey and your journey and what happened when he was 8?
Yeah, it's really nice. People ask a lot about how we're all doing, and I think of it as a really, really extremely nice byproduct of the book. There's a theme that runs throughout the book about the idea of a lattice, how when you don't have the traditional family structure anymore, friends, strangers, acquaintances that might not even know you that well, but they are looking out for your welfare in some way, and how that lattice is sometimes the only thing you have between you and oblivion. The people that have written letters over the years since the book came out have become a part of that, and I keep every letter, I read everything, and it's incredibly strengthening, I think, and sort of warming to know that people are out there and they care.
Well, we also want to talk to you about your new book, It's called Created in Darkness by Troubled Americans. Now, this is the best of the humor in your online magazine, McSweeney's. And you had another magazine years ago. It was called Might. Best known, I think, for faking the death of Eight Is Enough star Adam Rich.
Right. No, yeah, that was one of the unfortunate pranks we pulled, yeah.
Well, what are you trying to do with McSweeney's?
After Might, most of us moved to New York and actually took real jobs at real magazines.
Did you go to Esquire?
For a little under a year, I was there.
How did that go?
I didn't fit in so well. It was all my fault, not theirs. I was frustrated, and a lot of my friends were frustrated with not being able to publish this sort of thing that we had been used to publishing and having control over it. McSweeney's was just a home for pieces that had been killed by magazines, and it's just good work. And we let the contributors sort of guide it. Whatever we get through the mail sort of guides each issue.
Let's take a look, shall we, at one of my favorites, Pirate Riddles for Sophisticates. That's by Kevin Shea. Do you have your book there? It's on page 147.
Yeah. Let me just unmark. Okay.
Maybe I could do the Q and you could do the A. It's a Q&A. How's that? Okay?
Yeah.
Here we go. What's a pirate's favorite aspect of computational linguistics?
Parsing sentences. Oh. I would be doing like the real pirate thing if I just can't do it. You know,
arr.
Like I'm just going to play it a little flat.
Okay.
Sorry.
Here, let's do the very next one. Of all of Richard Harris's many achievements in the performing arts, which is a pirate's favorite?
MacArthur Park. it's so sad, isn't it? You know,
it really is.
Once you do it out loud, it's just not the same.
It really is.
It's embarrassing to everybody.
And the author realizes that about three quarters of the way through. He just sort of gives up as well and says, oh, this is getting ridiculous. But McSweeney's has short essays and long lists. One of my favorites is Possible Follow-Ups to One-Hit Wonders. There are titles such as How Are We Going to Get Those Dogs Back In? Bust an Additional Move. Seriously, Eileen, come on. What is it with lists?
I don't know. You know, a lot of the pieces in this collection come from the McSweeney's.net website, and it's one of the most popular links. I think we put about 100 of the lists in the book because they're, I don't know why, there's a certain rhythm to them and they build a certain momentum that they turn into the funniest things.
Just looking at that Possible Follow-Up Songs list again. Remember when you lit up my life? That was great. Follow-up.
I will now pass the duchy back to you and thank you for passing it to me originally because I really enjoyed the duchy. I don't know. These are just internet submissions from people that that write in and they just send their work, and nobody had been paid originally for the work. It's just sort of a communal effort. I think that I teach high school students, and I was just telling them there's probably, I would think, at least 100 excellent literary magazines in this country, and I think that we do that better than any other place in the world.
I'm interested in what you just said, though. You teach high school students. What do you teach them?
We have a nonprofit here called 826 Valencia, and we do drop-in tutoring and evening classes, and we send tutors into schools. And then I just teach a class once a week.
What do you tell them, Dave Eggers? What does a kid ask you about writing, and what do you tell them about good writing?
I feel like I made every mistake you could possibly make, and so I'm trying to prevent some of the students from wasting time in places that I did, I guess.
Wasting time? You were in sensation at, what, 29? I mean, what?
Yeah, 29. But, you know, we usually start with just, and we've learned this from some of the teachers here, one in particular, Jesse Madway at Thurgood Marshall High School. They start with just letting the students free write. Write any way you want to write. And then they worry about grammar and structure afterward. You see the influence of hip-hop in their work. You see the influence of The Cure. They love The Cure. And so you see some of the, they rip off some lyrics from The Cure. But it's them.
Dave Eggers is one of the editors of Created in Darkness by Troubled Americans, the best of McSweeney's humor category. Dave also was the author of A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. Dave Eggers, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Everything is kissable. Everything is kissable. is not a bad band to lift from. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.